VoodooMoose.net.
My friends, this is not a fireside chat.
Don't be jealous that I've been chatting online with babes all day.
They're in the computer?
Yes!
I don't believe it.
I know it.
Having the internet in our home has had a great impact on our lives.
We're not neurologically designed to withstand the temptations on offer online.
I'm deprived of the great development of radio. Oh my.
Yes! So you've got a whole generation that is living in a different world. And they live on screens.
Hello and welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Inagata DeVita, also known as Dustin. Today we're playing my interview with Purple Eyes WTF about his videos, his life, and what he's working on now. We will be playing the full, uncut, mostly unedited version, but also be sure to check out the Kind Soundwaves cut of this interview, which features samples of what we're talking about and some more segments. So Purple Eyes, or Nick, as he's known in the real world, grew up in the northeastern United States. While he was in college, he created Code Mint, an abridged series of Code Geass. Abridged series, of course, meaning episodic comedy fan dubs of an established TV series or movie. He was inspired by Little Karibo, creator of Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged. After discovering those videos, he decided he wanted to try making his own. Not too long after that, his abridged series gained popularity with fans on YouTube, and he began working on None Piece, a bizarre and hysterical parody of One Piece, which brought in even more people to his absurdist and fast-paced style. And let's not forget about the very funny animation and live-action content that he has created over the years. His style of humor, as well as the term Mint from Code Mint, was adopted by many other creators in the abridging community, possibly making him one of the most influential creators on the scene. Nick is well known by convention goers, friends, and fans to be an incredibly amicable and friendly person. These days, Nick has slowed down making videos and is living his life with his fiancée, working as a manager in a nuclear power plant. In this interview, we talk about his life, his videos, social media, YouTube algorithms, his future plans, and much, much more. So without any more introduction, I give you Purple Eyes WTF. Enjoy the show. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the media that you enjoyed as a kid and stuff like that. So you mentioned in an interview before that you had only really watched a few episodes of One Piece back in the day, but you loved it. Can you talk a little bit about watching TV and cartoons back when you were younger and the sort of landscape of things you were interested in back then?
Yeah, definitely. Space Ghost was a huge one. Space Ghost goes coast to coast.
Yeah, that's like almost the original Abridged series too.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, I'm sure there's, like, a common thread with most people who do this, that stuff, and, like, yeah. People who watch that show. But it was something that was on, it was something that was late at night, it was something that was hard to obtain. So naturally, like, you wanted to figure out when you could obtain it. That was the only show that I think I ever, like, calculated when it was on and how I could watch it. Other shows I would, like, watch passively, but I remember that one being a big influence. And then pretty much from then on, Adult Swim kind of stuff was stuff I looked into, maybe too much.
We'll see, like, One Piece was on Saturday morning. Did you?
Oh, yeah. Saturday morning cartoons. I remember every morning we'd kind of watch at like 6 a.m. There was Dragon Ball Z was on. I remember me and my brother watched a lot of episodes then.
Was that 97, 98?
I think so.
I remember DBZ being on Sunday mornings, and it would be on before we went to church. And I used to hate that show. I was like, this is the ugliest shit I've ever seen in my life. Later, I became like the biggest fan of all time. Yeah. I know like so much about it, but my first impression was not good.
Oh, that's funny.
Is a really ugly show. The colors and the designs, I mean, yeah. If you're not used to it,
yeah.
It's pretty shocking.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, there's another thing about aesthetic that like kind of interests me. Like I'll be more forgiving of like ugly shows a lot of the time. Just because I don't know. I don't know what it is.
You like when something has sort of its own unique visual style.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in that particular case, like with Dragon Ball Z, it was just on before, you know, we were going to school. So it was like watching anything was great. It was like, oh, cool. We're doing something right. Other than going to school.
Can we just do this all day?
Yeah. What the hell? I'm not learning anything in that other place. Oh, my God. I got so many stories about like just playing. I would figure out how many times I could be late or like absent and then like kind of fake sickness. I think everyone did that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, me too. But now that I'm like actually teaching in a class, I get so annoyed with kids who do that. Like,
I know. Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, looking back, you're like, oh my God.
Oh. So, what was your first anime?
First anime that I watched?
Yeah, or what you really remember, like, as an anime that you got into. You know how people do.
Yeah. Get into is probably different. It was probably, I think, when my parents had divorced, the block that was on late at night was more appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the shows that were set in space were more appealing to me because there was definitely like this isolationist feel to the show, but it's like you're part of that isolation. So I'm gonna go with either Cowboy Bebop or Outlaw Star.
Oh yeah, cool. Yeah, those are great. Yeah. I love those ones.
Actually, like probably more. Yeah, they're both the same.
Do you remember any hidden gems from when you were younger that maybe people don't really talk much about anymore?
Ooh, you know, I was trying to go through and figure out. Oh, you know what? People don't really talk about Frisky Dingo. I feel like that show didn't get as much credit as it should have because that's in my top like five of all funniest shows of all time.
Oh yeah, I remember that. I'm looking it up now. I remember this. It kind of looks a little bit like it's got the same animation style as Archer.
It is. It's from the guys that did, you know, at the same time Space Ghost was going on, they did Aqualab or what was it?
C-Lab 2020.
Yeah. C-Lab 2021. And, you know, that was just taking the, it was Space Ghost minus the talk shows. They were just doing their own storylines with the old footage, kind of like, you know, another precursor to abridging.
Mm-hmm.
And in that instance, they went on to make their own show with their own animated style, which is Frisky Dingo, which is the same thing as Archer. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. So how about comedic influences? What were some of your early comedic influences? You know, obviously, like, Space Ghost Coast to Coast and C-Lab 2021 have a lot to do with the bridging, but yeah. But what were some of the comedies that you really gravitated towards?
I mean, everyone, probably Monty Python.
Right.
That was definitely one for me. But when I was, I think I mentioned earlier, when I was like skipping school, I would stay home and like watch the stand-ups that were on daytime television because that's when they put them on. So, you know, they knew that like kids weren't supposed to be watching them. So that's probably influenced more than I'd like to admit. And Conan O'Brien, Jon Stewart, Ellen DeGeneres. I remember her.
She's actually really funny. Like her comedic style, it's relatable. It's really good.
Yeah, yeah. And then like as I progressed, you know, everyone's Louis C.K. I didn't hate Dane Cook as much as everyone else did. I think he got.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah. I loved his comedy. I listened to it so much back in the day. I still have fun listening to it.
Yeah, he knows how to whip up like a crowd, like a lot of charisma.
Yeah, he's a great performer. Yeah. Whether or not like his comedy is like top notch is really kind of irrelevant. When you go to his shows, there's so much energy and you're having fun. Like, what's the real difference there? I know he got in trouble for stealing jokes, but you know, there's even a charitable argument that maybe he didn't realize he was doing it. You know?
Yeah, so. And to be fair, like the industry did not know how to handle the internet, so. Yeah. I almost give him the benefit of the doubt just because like the internet was coming up the same time he was, and he got maybe like, you know, it was going to happen to somebody. So like, yes, it happened to him. And I thought he handled it the best out of everyone that has had that claim happen to them. But
right,
yeah, right now I'm on like, you know, kind of, I don't know what this says about me, but like, I would say the ones I'm looking at now are like Bo Burnham, kind of just like dissecting his Doug Stanhope.
Oh God, he's so funny. He's such a funny guy.
Yeah. Oh my. His style is like, oh, he lives that life.
When he speaks, like the way he speaks is like a comedy routine. Like he didn't even write it, but it's hilarious every time. It's like all you gotta do is talk, and you can make money.
The way the word just like gets spewed out, or like there's a pause because you know he's doing it as he's in the moment, you know, there's nothing pre-planned a lot of the times, or maybe if it is, it's like, you know, 70% pre-planned, but then there's always that, like, he's pausing to either remember it or like come up with something new on the spot. And when you get that rhythm going, oh, it's the best.
And the funny thing is too, that guy is such a heavy drinker, you know, like 100% of the time he's so drunk, he's like hammered, but he's still able to pull that out without any trouble at all. That's some real skill, real talent.
Yeah, yeah, he's on a lot of stuff, I'm sure.
How about Bill Burr? He's sort of in the same line.
Yeah, yeah, Bill, definitely. Oh god, Bill Burr, and then there's this who's the guy that his big bit was the trailer voice guy. One man, one way. God.
Pablo Francisco?
Pablo Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah. Little tortilla boy. Little tortilla.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. I've always been a huge stand-up comedy nerd.
Yeah. Same here. And I feel like I'm really doing a poor job of explaining, like, all, like, the underdogs right now. Like, Amy Wong, I think is her name. She just did Baby Cobra.
Yeah.
That was great. Who else? Who did War Paint? I think it's War Paint. I want to say it starts with an I.
Eliza Schlesinger?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I saw her live. She came to my town.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a great bit.
Oh, that's
awesome. She, it's a college town, and she spent like 20 straight minutes making fun of our mascot, and everyone was dying. She did, like, and obviously she didn't plan that out. She just wrote it there when she was there. It was fantastic.
Yeah. I'm not doing enough credit to like all the other names too, because I've seen like a bunch of live ones too, and I just saw these guys. They're called Legion of Skanks. I guess the headliner, I don't know. I feel like they're all very damn good, but the headliner was Jay Okerman. I think I'm saying that right. He's really good too. So funny. It's like really colorful, and all his like metaphors, they're so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, I could keep going, but we'd be here for days.
Right, that's a whole different podcast.
Yeah.
Stand-up comedy with Purple Eyes and Indigo DeVito. So let's move along then. So let's talk about the internet. When did you first start using the internet, and what was your early experience like when you were on it?
That's a good question. Everyone's experience with it first, because we're like kind of the generation that was exposed to it.
Yeah, it wasn't there the whole time. It came about, and I remember being a kid and like, what is this .com? Why is everything .com now? What does that mean?
I know. And then when you found .org, there's a difference. Like
.edu, get out of here.
I was definitely an early adapter, because my mother had an IBM laptop, and I remember she brought it home. And not a lot of stuff on it. Obviously, like Internet Explorer was there. I remember, like, she'll always tell this story where, like, she couldn't even figure out how to open it because it was weird. It had, like, latches. And I most definitely, like, forced it open. But, like, I figured out where one latch was, didn't know where the other one was, and just, like, really ripped it open and then started playing with it. And definitely, I think, like, everyone has sort of, like, the same experience to a certain point. But it was like, AOL chat rooms. I remember like trying to mess with someone when you're like 9 or 8. It's not like they whomped me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It was just interesting to me that like you could talk to strangers and no one would know who you are. But like I remember that being important later on, being like, okay, you have anonymity, but they can like still, you know, call you out and stuff, and like just what you're typing could like give away stuff about you. So they straight up like called, they're like, what are you, 8? I was like, damn. Yeah, I'm 8.
Foiled again. So that, if you had to guess, it'd probably be like early 2000s.
Yeah.
So the laptop that was connected to the internet, that'd have to be like
early 2000s. Yeah, yeah, probably, yeah.
So when did you first discover abridging, and who did you watch early on?
So it was my friend Joe, who had seen Karibo's stuff, and I was in college at the time in Vermont. And I had like a very passing experience with, what the hell is the show? Oh my God. Yu-Gi-Oh! Oh, that's great. Oh, like I forgot everything at once. Yeah.
You know, the hair,
the hair, the and monsters. The cards.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, my cousin was big into it, and my cousin had introduced me to it. And I have like a really long story. I actually tried, like, not really stand up, but you know how you go to those conventions and you can like talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
I would try to like work out a little routine in the, I call it like the safer version of a stand up, because it's just a bunch of anime guys. They're not going to,
right?
How badly can they judge you? Because you can immediately judge them. Hey, you came to an anime convention. then they can call you out for being there too and be like, all right. So you kind of all, you know, you're in the same
boat.
We're on
an even playing field.
Yeah. But I remember I had this like bit where basically like Yu-Gi-Oh was burned into my brain, not only because of my cousin's love for it. And by the way, I was a roommate with my cousin when I moved back to Manhattan College, but like he would literally, the story's too long and kind of embarrassing. I don't want to say too much, but he like kind of would urinate in the corner right while like I was watching the show.
Wait, was there some receptacle for the urine?
No, it was just a corner. He wasn't very well house trained. And this is like to the point where you should know better. Like I was probably like 10 or 11, and he was a year younger than me, so 9 or 10. So that was like, it was traumatizing, but it was hilarious. So it wasn't like a bad trauma. So that I just remember watching that show, and I remember even like the episode was this one where I think Joey is battling some guy and his sister is in a cage being lowered into water. And I specifically remember like latching onto the water because like the sound effects coming from my cousin, I wasn't sure if that was the television or what he was doing. Oh, like running water. Wow, that sounds so real. But that definitely was the reason why I was able to be like, okay, I'm definitely going to watch this because I do know about Yu-Gi-Oh! And at least I like it to the point where it's like, you know, had an impact on me.
A strong association with urine.
And comedy, ironically enough. So like, you know, those two things seem to go together perfectly. Why not watch Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged?
Well, it seemed to have a lasting memory on you. Thank God you were watching Yu-Gi-Oh! When your cousin was peeing, or you might have forgotten that he peed in the corner.
I know, yeah. Could have been totally different. Yeah, definitely his. And then, like, that just seemed to me like to be, like, the perfect path. Like, you know, it was Space Ghost, C-Lab, and then Abridging, so, yeah.
So you were, that was in 2008 that Lil Karibo started, and you opened your channel in 2009. So how long were you sort of just taking it in before you decided to jump in yourself?
Playing with the idea? Probably... like it was probably pretty immediate. It's probably pretty immediate. And where I was like, I could do this, and then just figuring out how to do it. And then I started on like Windows Movie Maker.
Yeah.
You know, I think so did he. I'm just guessing. I don't
Me
know.
Too.
But yeah. Yeah. Everyone. Yeah. There you go. Everyone kind of did that. And then I remember redoing them, but it wasn't too long. There wasn't like a huge pause. It just seemed like, okay, I've got a computer. I remember going out to the Palisades Mall, which is like, I think it's like one of the third biggest malls in America, and buying one of those USB microphones.
So you did Code Geass Abridgment.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so I really want to ask you about that because I have this fascination with the word abridging. it's already very esoteric by itself. You have to know a little bit about what you're jumping into before you get there to know what to expect. But like, so you've come up with an even further bastardization, with the Ment. Did you come up with that? Was that you?
Yeah.
And then other people picked it up, and now Ment is a thing. It's a thing like Abridged is.
It's a thing within a thing.
Yeah. And so, I just want to hear what you have to say about it. Like where did you come? Where did that come from, and why would you use that instead of like, you know, the typical abridged moniker?
That's a good question. So I definitely knew that I wanted to be on this line. I wanted to ride this line. I was like, I want to be different enough so that, like, you know, I want to pay homage to, obviously, it's obvious what I'm doing. It's pretty much the same thing. It's almost exactly the same thing. But if I ever want to be like, there's nuances in my stuff that aren't particular to abridging or, you know, that particular, what's thought of as that particular thing, it can be differentiated. You can see like, okay, well, this means this and that means that. It's just easier, I thought, for like me to identify a difference. And there was definitely some part of me that was like, okay, you have less control over kind of how people perceive you if just the title, if they're just entering into the title itself. And that's as far as many people go. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people listening to this are people who are specifically fans of like abridging and menting. So it's all one to them. They know, like, you know, mm-hmm. the deviations. But like, at least on a surface level, I think it's easier to approach, okay, this is abridged and this is all the things associated with this. This is ment. it's pretty much the same thing. If there's one or two things I can extrapolate that are different, which, I mean, then it kind of got out of control, I'm sure now. I know there was other people who did what I was doing and used the title, and I think that's awesome. But it became its own thing. It was just interesting to watch it evolve kind of in a parallel.
Yeah. How would you describe it if you had to describe what is different about a mint and what is different about than an abridged? How would you describe it?
So now, if I'm going to step outside myself and kind of think about like what everyone generally thinks of it when they hear it. Fast-paced. Surreal is giving it too much credit. So lol random seems to be like, you know, the through line.
Chaos, high energy.
Yeah. Yes.
Absurdist.
Exactly. Absurdist. That's the perfect word. Absurdist. I had like a lengthy debate with somebody about like what absurdist comedy was. It totally not in relationship to anything we've ever done, but it was interesting. I recognize that it's like not as easy to follow, and absurdist humor is extremely difficult because you have to kind of, I like, oh, another show I really like is Aqua Team Hunger Force. It's absurd, but it's grounded in this real weird reality, which is why it's a great juxtaposition of like, you know, content.
Yeah.
So you have to just accept that there's food that is talking to you. And it's almost like a way to wink at the audience, be like, hey, listen, we know this is a television show. So if you garner that kind of like understanding as an audience member, I think that's how you get like a specific following and a specific identity.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I think I think there's a lot of there's a great deal of awareness that you had coming into it, like of differentiation, of identity and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You were 20 when you started. So, I mean, you're pretty much an adult. So
yeah, it was 19 or 20. I remember it was like right around. I was trying to figure out the timeline too. Birthday.
You started when you were in college?
Yeah. And my birthday is in April. I think I started like, yeah, I was in 19 or 20.
Can you talk a little bit about starting your YouTube channel back in, I think, 2009? What was it like early on?
So my cousin was there and I kind of imagined this is, I think I have a different perspective on how I like approach stuff. So I was going to immediately pick a show that I knew at the time. I was 20 and aware enough to know that this would not do well. And I was extremely self-deprecating at that age. I know that for a fact. So, I think I would approach it so that, I always wanted play rivalries, and looking back now, I think that's the dumbest thing I did. I still lament this one line when I was like going through it, and I love this team that's called Team Fart Taco.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
and I just like, I always thought that like we were all aware enough to be like, okay, if you get featured in another person's channel, that's ultimately good for you. And because you're a stupid like teenager / 20-year-old, you really don't know what you're doing at the time. And now looking back, I really wish I hadn't have done this. It's like, you know, the joke is kind of at their expense, which like pisses me off looking back at it. I almost want to re-edit everything, but I'm just like, just leave it. I'm sure they're great guys, by the way. I'm sure they don't give a shit. But like,
have you met them?
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 We talked for a while. As a matter of fact, I told them I was going to like use their stuff, but I never really followed up. So I don't really know what they think about that. And then they stopped like doing what they wanted to do anyway. I'm sure everyone just like kind of learns what they learn and goes their separate ways. Yeah. I'm sure I'm now at that boat, which is why it's nice to be back looking.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, because you get like really have an understanding of the complete saga.
Yeah, and like now I'm always interested in analyzing what happened and what I did. But anyway, the question you asked is like how I got it started. It was me and my cousin. I had bought that USB mic and I would just find places to record around the dorm. Yeah, and I put that together and I put it up and I didn't think too much of it. I'm sure I had crazy aspirations that I couldn't even like put a finger on now if I wanted to. But like, you know, the world is so confusing to somebody who's in college, and the bits of information that you get are just like, you know, that access you have to the internet and that stuff you have on television, which is not telling of the real world. I remember having revelations after that being like, oh, this is what it's like, you know, actually is. So now where I'm like looking at television is like, it's kind of like I don't want to say it's like a kid oriented thing because there's adult content everywhere. But like, you know, mainstream cable seems to work in this box that's just like general and it's fun. It's fun, but I'm looking for something more right now. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The, there's sort of a blandness that arises whenever you're trying to appeal to everybody, because it's just sort of...
I know
of,
what you mean, and it's almost aesthetically bland, too, because I can't pick out certain people out of a lineup unless I've attached, like, some serious... I'm always trying to figure out, like, in my demographic, who is the most notable, quote-unquote, movie star that's, like, around my age right now, and I would just say it's Jordan Peterson. Not, oh my God, not Jordan Peterson. You can edit that out. Please edit that out. Oh my God.
Pretty sure he's not an
actor. He's not an actor. And I was just thinking of him because of, oh my God, I was listening to something that my fiance showed me. It was interesting. But no. It's,
oh, what was it? What was it? I'm interested to hear.
Oh, it was, he's, you probably, I like the Joe Rogan podcast. If you like Bill Burr and you like, Doug Stanhope, probably seen that. And they're like in the middle of this interesting debate, and like it gets all political. And I know, like, I don't know dick about politics, but what I am trying to do, and this is interesting. Yeah, you can leave this in, I don't care. Is I'm trying to expose myself to more than just the bubble I was currently in. And that's one of the things I noticed as I was like on Reddit. And I was thinking about this from a computer science perspective. That's my degree. And I've done a little bit of programming, enough to know like kind of how the basic outline of how the algorithms would work in relationship to their thumbs up, thumbs down system. So like,
right.
If you think about it in a mathematical curve, I think eventually what you're going to do is, and this is just a theory, I have a bunch of theories and they're probably all wrong, but you'll... Even it has to be 50-50 for like any kind of controversial view, because if your audience is 60-40, you'll continuously push down one view, continuously push up another view. The people who are getting pushed down feel like they're disenfranchised or something like that. So then they'll go somewhere else where, like, you know, it's just them. You're kind of maybe not forcing a bubble, because
it's almost like we're at a battle where it's almost like people are having an ideological battle with the algorithms themselves. It's like,
And I wish there was more like awareness of how they operate, because that might
help.
You're
doing it yourself. I mean, you just said you're actively seeking other points of view.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it takes. But the thing is that not everyone has the initiative or the drive to do something like that.
Yeah. And I think the catalyst for that is, like, in order to do comedy, you want to have at least all sides accounted for. You know, you don't want to specifically alienate. You want to say something that's like, you know, I mean, like the most appealing comedy anyway, I think, is like it takes everything on both sides and be like, this is something I've noticed. Like, I'm trying to do that more and more. And then I've exposed myself to another thing. But what's interesting is that once you do that, I've been doing this a lot now to understand how YouTube's algorithm works. This is such a deviation from your original question. I remember it too.
No, it's fine.
Okay. What I've been doing is I've been resetting, cause you can do this really easy. My mobile devices, cause YouTube is like one of the last bastions of entertainment I'm using as, on the internet. I'm like, I'm falling out of so many because it's just, it's difficult for me to do it. And to engage on a lot of these platforms. But anyway, the YouTube one is interesting because I've learned a couple of things, and I have a couple of theories also as to what's going on, by just resetting my history, looking at one thing, and it's like really easy to, like, you know, then scroll and look through and like, okay, maybe it's this way, maybe it's that way. And here's a theory I've read, and here's something this is my own theory. So
okay,
the algorithm basically works, you know, the more comments you get, the more views you get populated more in the recommended for you. And it's all about that. It's all about getting populated in the recommended for you, below the videos you're watching. Mm-hmm. So one of the new things that drives that is this thing they want to avoid. And this I know for a fact is the bounce rate. They don't want people to go on the site, watch one video and leave the site. So in order to lower the bounce rate, I think I'm saying that right, they have it so that a video that brings someone onto the channel from another platform, like, so let's say a social media site like Twitter, Reddit, or Vine, and YouTube, at least knows it's Google, so they have everyone's information.
Yeah.
But since YouTube's own thing, they know when you've started a session, when you come on, you know, and then when you've gone to another video. And so what's interesting about that, I think in particular, is that, okay, so you, if you have a good Reddit following and you decide to be a video creator, you'll tell everyone on Reddit, hey, I have this video. They go onto YouTube, then they'll be like, oh, and then what's interesting is what's really winning this algorithm is, like, this is where it gets dangerous, is if it's controversial and the video, I call it the derivative of video effect. The video is about another video. So of course you're going to go to that other video that's on the site. That, like, you know, if you're talking for hours and hours and end about, like, you know, I don't know, kids eating Play-Doh or something, you're going to go to these videos where, oh my God, these kids are recording themselves eating Play-Doh.
New trends are sweeping the nation. The youth are eating Play-Doh.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it becomes a trend. Like the Tide Pod thing, somebody's commenting on the Tide Pod thing because maybe one or two kids did that, and then we're like, oh, this is how you're sort of networking a subculture in YouTube that's, like, getting its own popularity,
right,
by having people comment on how stupid it is and having the people actually doing the stupid thing.
Right. Yeah. Reactions, whether they're positive or negative, actually, when they're negative, it's almost better for it. I mean, you were just talking about Jordan Peterson. That's a person who was propelled into the spotlight because of the reaction to him was so out of proportion from what he was saying that it just instantly made him a superstar in the eyes of everyone that hated the people who hated him.
It's
a really weird thing. And there's another thing too that you kind of touched on a little bit too. There's this odd aspect of the algorithm that really has to do with momentum. If you've got a lot of people watching it and it gets recommended more, well, then you get more people watching it. And then it creates sort of the perception that there is more, that this is actually more important than it really is. And I think the perfect example is Logan Paul.
This is
a guy who's, by all accounts, boring and not interesting whatsoever.
It's funny you use that word. I want to remember that. Okay, yeah.
Sorry. But he is on top of the world right now, and I think a large part of that has to do with the momentum that was behind him.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the way I've discovered to, like, to make a lot of these controversial topics, like, kind of resolve maybe 50% of it is just to make it boring again. Once you make it boring, you could just, like, you know, kind of let, like, you know, I don't know. I'm no scientist in that regard. But yeah, it's interesting. He definitely has an appeal. I was trying to stand out outside of it, like, even more. It's like, I remember this one kid who was a fan who was talking about him was like, we don't have to talk about Logan Paul for that long, but he was like, he was one of the few personalities that's talking about celebrating himself, you know? And I recognize that I'm specifically a person who pushes away from that. The second I see someone celebrating themselves, I'm like, you're a narcissist. No, no, no. It's like, there's probably a healthy intermediate between me and Logan Paul.
Yeah.
It's like, I hate all forms of narcissism. And I'm learning now that, like, no, that's not the case. It's like, you can't literally, like, you know, do anything yourself without hating it. Like, you are a vehicle for whatever you do, so you can't hate you.
Right, yeah.
And he's a guy who, like, draws people in. He would definitely have drawn in my brother to his personality, because you can kind of, and he said this himself, you can kind of live through him. You can live through proxy. But I've always said that there's also a cost to that that maybe people don't take into account. Like, it's interesting. It's interesting. There's costs to everything.
Yeah.
But I think, like, to your point earlier, that, like, if you're just telling yourself you're right all the time, you're not realizing what you're missing by giving yourself a pat on the back. So,
yeah, you know how, and I don't want to give myself a pat on the back, but one of the ways that I feel like I've sort of moved a little bit further in that mindset is never deciding that I know what is true.
Yeah.
Always being okay, not being conclusive on certain things.
Yeah.
Being like, okay, well, that's a good argument. I measure things by argument. I'm like, that's a good argument. That's not a good argument. Yeah. I'm not convinced by that argument. That's how I say it. Not that's true. I say, I'm not convinced by that argument.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think there's, you know, there's something to that. like, and I've also just been recently, like, I have to catch myself constantly, though, because, you know, if we're going to talk about along those lines, you know, you got your Jordan Peterson, and then I feel like everyone kind of knows the opposite of that is, like, kind of the Sam Harris and the Steven Pinker and the Brett Weinstein.
The new atheists.
Yeah. But I caught myself doing that again. Harris was in an argument with these Vox people, and like
I heard that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think I was like given the Vox. I was like, I don't know, but like what's Vox's take on it? And I noticed that I was like just gonna immediately side with Harris. I was like, wait a minute, let me hear what they have to say. I'm in the middle of that right now, so I have no comment on it, which is great.
Yeah.
These things are long.
Yeah, they are. And that one, I had to listen to it in chunks because I just kept getting so annoyed. I'm like, oh, you did not answer the question. I was really curious to hear what you were going to say, and you just played politics, damn it.
I know. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of moments where I was like, oh, shoot, I'll have to save this for later.
that's fantastic. It's so rare that to meet somebody who's listening to these same people and interacting with these debates that are going on. So
yeah. I imagine we were, and maybe I can like just quickly and like concisely. So in our arena, I'm just always trying to think about like how I'm affected by the algorithm. One of the things is retention. So those long form stuff that obviously does better and comes to our attention better. And the other theory I got going now is, you know how they do the image search? They used to do the image search for, and this is probably very relatable. They'd used to do the image search to figure out, like, you know, who's like uploading what copyrighted material and visuals.
Yeah.
I have a sneaking suspicion, and I would probably do this too, that they're not only using it to find and flag copyright like material, but to also lump together search interests. To like, you know, okay. So the bots kind of probably work like this. They probably see like, you know, general, they probably have, I call them bots, but it's really just a program that sees like, you know, a general image, and it takes the general image and it tries to find an exact match to that image. And if it can't find an exact match, it breaks it down by color. It probably breaks it down by like, you know, saturation, brightness, whatever. So if it's doing that, it's not too far-fetched to believe that you could potentially do that across videos. So say like, okay, there's a lot of this color. I'm just being really general right now. This is my theory. So I don't know if this is true. There's a lot of, it would be better to like, all right, there's a lot of blue in this video. Recommend the viewer watching this video who really likes blue, find other blue videos that also fit all these other categories and recommend that first and foremost. So in instances where it's like, you know, the animation is Dragon Ball Z, you can find Dragon Ball Z footage from people who are talking about it, not only, you know, using the keywords, but actually have the footage and then populate that more often. So, and I tried to test this. I deleted my my history. I picked a video. I was like scrolling through and tried to pick a very specific video where like the thumbnail was clearly like not black and white, but like beige. You know, so gonna have like a good, and the second I did, I closed out of the app, opened it up again, and looked at every video on there, and they were a surprising amount of beige colored, like, you know, old timey videos that weren't probably directly linked, but somewhat linked to that first video that I had watched and put on my history.
Well, you know, I've never really thought about that, of the bots sort of analyzing visual data as well. I mean, one of the things I learned about the YouTube algorithm is that not even the people who designed them know how they work exactly, because what they've done is they've just put these random AI bots out to work recommending videos, and they'd separate their audience and compare who was more successful, and they sort of use the evolutionary mindset. Whichever one reduced the bounce rate or increased the viewer retention rate, they were the ones they kept, and the other ones were tossed to the side. And so they kept doing this and kept doing this and kept doing this. So nobody really knows exactly how they're picking the videos, but whatever they're doing, it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
And it's weird. People talk about like AI taking over and us having like this huge existential crisis with AI.
Yeah.
It's already happening. These algorithms are determining like what we're looking at and the information we're taking in. It's crazy.
I know. It stresses me out to the point where I don't want to watch YouTube anymore. yeah.
But that is a really interesting conversation, and, yeah. and definitely something that I would like to talk about. But you know, we got a lot of other stuff to get to.
Here. Yeah, yeah. Anytime you want to, let me know because I'm like really fascinated by it.
Yeah. So I've seen people call Code Mint a parody of a parody. So what do you make of this description, and what was your intention when you were as you progressed through the show?
It was supposed to be a parody. It wasn't, you know. Because I was making it as like still like a young adult, I was probably more feeling out what a parody could be. And I noticed that it wasn't direct, but I would definitely get a direct concept in my head first and then kind of boil it down to, it was weird because normally it's backwards, but there was elements where I'd have the large concept and then try to boil it down, have the you know, stupid joke. And then sometimes stupid jokes would just come to me that spoke about a larger concept. So, you know, they kind of worked in tandem. A parody of a parody. That's interesting because I remember Space Ghost Goes Coast to Coast. One of the editors like was talking about how it was post-modern to where they're making fun of making fun of making fun.
Oh, my God. So, it's infinitely recursive.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I'm sure there's probably a parallel there. I honestly haven't. I don't know.
You know, it sounds more like there's not just a parallel. There's a whole endless possibilities there. I think we need to find the singularity point of that to where something becomes, it just fully turns in on itself and becomes completely genuine.
Yeah, I know. I know. At what point does that happen? I think I was trying to play with that like recently.
Really?
I don't know. I don't know when that occurs, but yeah, that's a good question.
We will never know. let's say, None Piece, for example, what led you to take on One Piece?
One Piece. So I had a rule at the time. Definitely. I remember this very vividly. Only do shows that you remember when you were little specifically, because I'd have a connection to it and kind of like, you know, understood at least somewhat of the characters, and One Piece I had at least seen up to a certain point. And ironically enough, I think I hit that point. Now I'm like kind of done with the series. Yeah. It's visually the easiest out of everything. The eyes are, you can move eyes around more. So a lot of it is just like mechanical.
Yeah.
Choices. It's like, okay, they were just black dots. I know how to cover over black dots with white eyes so I can make them look wherever they want. Very easy, very simple. I felt like, you know, Dragon Ball Z was already a thing. I was going to use None Piece. It's just a playground.
Yeah.
It's just a playground for me to figure out kind of what I'm doing and what I'm not doing right. But so is everything else I do. So I don't think it's specific to that one, but it's the easiest playground for me to fuck up in.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, in that vein, if it's sort of like learning experience, practice and stuff like that, what have you learned from doing abridging that you were able to take and apply to other things as well?
Definitely abridging on the whole, you have to approach a problem that seems problems can get infinitely more complex as you look at them and as you take in more information. So like the original days, it's literally just plug in a mic, don't even think about it, and start like talking about stuff. But then as everyone evolved, everyone evolved, like I think making videos overall, you got to learn, like, you know, what they're learning and what you're learning, and be like, oh wow, you can make this sound better. You can make, so a lot of playing in None Piece, you kind of learn like tempo. You kind of learn, I think a lot of people would try to like head off what people were going to say. This is another thing I think a lot of people do. You immediately kind of know what the audience members are going to think and say before you release something. I remember one time I was like, you know what? I think I should just make a list and be like, because you're looking at the audience and the audience is looking at you. Now I try not to do that anymore. I try not to look at the audience because I feel like there's such a wide berth and the information you get is just from the people typing stuff in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point too. There's so much out there that you have. It's just a dark area. You have no idea how people are reacting.
Yeah. Yeah. So approaching problems is like probably the biggest one. And then, if anyone ever needs, oh, and then like kind of, if anyone's trying to like ever sell me stuff or like, you know, just videos in general, I'll think about in a larger context. I remember I was like watching this video and there was a conversation with the off-camera person, and immediately like I was able to populate at least a more accurate depiction of what could have been going on in that instance than what like normally people just hear. So it was interesting. My fiance, soon to be wife, was saying like she thought this about this particular interaction. I was like, that can't be the case, because the stagehand is like, he's probably doing this. He's definitely like, you know, got to worry about this, that.
Yeah.
And the thing he's talking about is like,
you think you're
without going into too
much detail. Like you're thinking about media from the perspective of a creator.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's changed my worldview a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. You know what it did to me is it made me not like things that other people like.
Yeah.
And then I just became that guy.
I know. And you don't want to be that guy. So even then I'll like give him like the devil's due and be like, oh, you know, creator aside, this is great for what it is on that side. But that's exceedingly harder for me now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's difficult to purge from my brain how it came to be, why it came to be, theories about how these things came to be and why they came to be, because a shot will tell you more than you think if you know more about how a shot is constructed. That's a good word.
Yeah. Well, it is very odd how in doing a bridge series, just this little hobby that people have, what you end up really getting into is writing.
Yeah.
Editing, filmmaking almost. I mean, I don't want to get too far into that, but like, yeah. it really does give you that example of like, oh, you know, dealing with collaborating with people, you know,
yeah.
and all of these skills that are involved in media, they're there.
Yeah.
Even if it is just this little fun little hobby, you know?
Yeah. It's universal. It's definitely like applicable to other feels, and like right now I'm like really fascinated with just engineering stuff people would find boring as hell. but I think a part of that is because you kind of just see how things are put together.
Yeah.
So like once you understand, like, you know, okay, this video isn't just the end product. And I remember the first job I ever had, first real job, I was a lifeguard for a while, but was like a programmer for one of the worst bosses I ever had, and he will readily admit he was one of the worst bosses I ever had. But I remember something, he struck a chord with me. It was like, you know, we used to have 14-hour days and we were programming in like time blocks of like 12 hours or like 11 hours. And then we would drive from Edison, which is in the middle of New Jersey, Edison, New Jersey, to, you know, upstate New York, quote unquote upstate. It's not that upstate. It's like 45 minutes north.
Yeah.
But and like, after a brutal day, and he was such a bad communicator, but after a brutal day of like working under him and getting yelled at from him, when like, you know, you even asked a question and he couldn't readily answer it. It was insane. I remember one thing he specifically said that was like, you know, a lot of people don't think about how these street signs are put together. I do. Like, you know, I think about the factory and I think about all that. And like, it struck a chord with me. It was like, oh yeah. Despite everything I thought about that guy, I was like, he's got an amazing point. And that made me appreciate his point. And I was able to connect like a little better there. Unfortunately, like, you know, the hours were ridiculous and the pay was horrible.
Yeah. Didn't make that better.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that was, it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it. Looking back now, but I will never put myself through something like that again and devalue my time that badly.
Yeah. Yeah. Devalue your time. That's a really good way of putting it. Cause it really is. It's something that people don't think about whenever they're doing things like that, but it's true.
No. And when you're younger, yeah, it's like, you know, I have all this free time. It's like, I think in your subconscious, like recognize, it's like, I got tons of free time, so much potential. Like I can do whatever the hell I want. Like,
so when you were programming, was that after or before you had started abridging?
That was after, definitely after.
So, yeah. So without all that time, what was the what time period did you have a gap in your output?
Oh, definitely the biggest one. That's a good point. Was I was working on an episode, and at that job, that's probably when the gap started. I finished the episode because I had started the job like almost, I was like 95% done with the episode and I had started the job. So it's like, okay, great. And I really liked that episode. And I was working downstairs. It was my kitchen and, hardwood floor. I had the cord wrapped around. I literally, it was like rendering. It was in the middle of rendering. It was like 90% done. And I celebrated just a moment too early. I kicked my chair back. I was like, yes. And the cord took the laptop, smashed it on the floor, could not be recovered. It broke up. The hard drive was broken because it was rendering. It corrupted the data and everything. You know, they say, like, you know, make sure this is plugged into the wall because you don't want this to go out right when you're rendering.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the most devastating thing for me. And then, so that was when there was the biggest gap in output. I redid the episode thinking that if I redid this episode, no matter what, I would never worry about the gaps between episodes. And now the problem is I really don't care. Way farther on the spectrum, to the point where it's like, I'm pretty much done, but I always have one project on the back burner to satiate that voice in your brain that goes like, you could make another one. It'd be really great. It'd be really fun. Or, like, you know, maybe it won't be really fun, but you should definitely be doing it. So I just have one on the back burner that's probably on the back burner for forever.
Yeah.
And I think if I made it, I think everyone would like it. You know, I've checkmarked all the boxes, everyone from our community, everyone from, you know, the audience perspective. There's nothing negative about it at all. So I like it. But and because it's so great in my mind, I'm just like, just leave it there. That's where it'll stay.
No, you got to put it out, dude. You got to put it out.
Yeah, I know.
People I'll miss try. You, man.
Yeah, I'll try, but I'll sit down and there's this weight that occurs just when recording.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, oh God. Cause you think about all the other steps you have to go through and things you have to worry. Cause the problem is compounded now, which is like, you got to worry about audio and visual. And, like, you know, I've learned to let things go. My last one, it was like, I think Dave Willis, the guy that made Aqua Team Hunger Force, said it best. It's like, it's pens down. It's like, once you're done and you got to not think about it. And the problem was, I even now, this is another thing that, like, at to what point is there too much of a cost? I think about the last thing I put out and be like, God damn it, I could have done this.
Yeah. What scene is that?
There's a scene where it's basically the exact same scene, but there's music to it and it ends with just an explosion and there's not really like a really good punchline. He's basically doing this almost the same thing as in the show. Just different. The tone is a little bit different because there's music and he's like, different sound effects, but he's just trying to slap a fly and all of a sudden he pops up and then he pops up twice because he's quote unquote so fast. And then, like, a month after it was put out, I was like, oh my God, what I should have done was had the fly on his hand. It would take a little bit more editing and I didn't want to do this, but cut out his hand and then just have him like smack the fly 20 million times. Explosions are coming out and then the fly is not dead and it just like flies out of his hand. <It's> just, yeah. It would have avoided looking like the exact same scene. It would have been its own thing. And I'm like, fuck. I even now I want to go back and make a second episode and like reference to the first one and have that have been the scene. But I'm like, don't do that. You'll just waste even more of your time.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I'm getting at the point where I don't even look at the things I've made. I just keep moving ahead.
Yeah.
Because I just torture myself over stuff like that. There's this one scene in a video that I made where every time it comes up, I'll like skip past it on the video player if I'm watching it, which I used to watch my own videos all the time, just like trying to wrap my head around it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But when that part would come up, I would have to skip it because it was just too painful to watch it. I would cringe. I'd feel it in my stomach. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah, we're the only ones that are like really experiencing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one I must have watched over 30 times from front to back. Like, I tried to figure out if it was good on from a laptop's perspective, you know, from that sound card, and then like from listening to it on a phone.
Oh,
and there were
wow.
like harsh tones on the phone. So I literally, no one will appreciate, like, no one really appreciates the audio, but I would go through.
That's
and,
the, you know what that is? That's the mindset of a programmer.
Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. You're like, I got to try this on different devices to see if the results are the same.
That's exactly what I did. And so, like, on the listening to it on the mobile, I was like, oh my God, there's like a harshness that I can't listen to using the iPhone headphones that I have to eliminate. So I would like cut out the bass.
Whoa. Nobody would ever know that you did that.
I know. It sucks too. But I was like, this is hurting my, and I can tell because people would be like, hey, listen, this audio is harsh. And I'm like, they're right.
Wow.
So I always listen to stuff like that. And Mike, you know, One Kids, he was always helpful in kind of exploring that with me, which is why it's so good to bounce ideas off other people too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Mike, man. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So when it comes to abridging as a whole, what do you like about it and what do you dislike about it?
Yeah. So I like, you know, learning that aspect is always cool. It's always interesting to see how people react to that. And I really enjoyed going to those conventions. And I think my experience is radically different from a lot of other people's experiences. I've been to like about, I don't know, I'd say 10 or 11, a lot. That is another amazing thing. I always like people's reaction to what you're doing, and the face-to-face stuff is the best. And one of the ways I kind of I'm drawn to more than just the, you know, the video and the audio itself and what you're putting together in terms of like the audience's participation is like there's video games, that level of interaction, and that level of interaction was kind of spelled out for me pretty well when it came to who is that guy that I really like. He does the Metal Gear Solid games.
Kojima.
Yeah. There's one of those puzzles that he made, which solidified how people interact with their media for me on a physical level. Cause I never really thought about having the controller in my hand. I kind of knew there was that level of interactivity, but he would physically force you in some of his puzzles to solve them by using what's in your hand. The greatest example is where you'd have to, when you were playing Metal Gear Solid, there was a puzzle where you'd unplug the controller from the first port and plug it into the second.
Yeah.
You know, so it made like you actively aware of what you were doing.
Kojima has this fascinating way of doing his games where there's a meta level awareness.
Yeah.
And bringing people into the moment of what they're actually doing in physical space is something that's so unlike what video games are and what they try to be that it's artful. I mean, I don't mean to play it up too much, but it really is. It's something that's an experience you can't have with anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can't do that in a movie theater, and maybe movie theaters revolve, so you can do that. Who knows? But I think there's a lot of potential to be explored there, and that's kind of an aspect of abridging that I liked because it gave you the opportunity to be less passive in understanding your media, which is kind of what we've been talking about this whole time, I guess. Things I don't like about it are there's not enough interactivity with the audience. It's on an ever-changing platform. So, you know, one day you could be benefited by doing this and, you know, having this kind of style, and the next it's like devastating because, you know, you're doing the wrong things. You're maybe saying things that you thought were like safe. And I was like, oh man.
Do you have any bit of that? I mean, I talked to Little Kribo a little bit about, you know, like jokes that he regrets. Can you think of anything where when you look back on it, you're like, okay, there was something I really didn't understand when I made that joke.
Yeah. Nothing. I mean, the thing that pops out is again, when I was like, you know, it was clear that I didn't understand why I was starting to abridge. So like, I remember, the example's perfect, but the video's not there because I redid all the first episodes. There's this guy, no one's going to remember. It's okay. It's Uwardii, I think is his name. It's Uwardii. Like, he made a pretty good point about an excellent critique about what I was doing. And like, you know, in response, I playfully like tried to explode his characters, but he didn't, his critique was so presented well enough. And I was self-aware enough to like, you know, I took that in and was like, that's like really smart. So like, I regret having this mentality of where like, you know, oh, everyone's going to assume that my play fighting is in loving. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone in the bridging community knows that I'm play fighting, and that's fine. And I've never done that since. That's great. But like, when I play fought the actual industry, I don't think there was some more malice there that I half regret and half don't. Like, you know, there's jokes about Jessica Alba's movie career that I'm like, was that really necessary? Like,
do you feel like in retrospect they were too mean-spirited?
Yes, exactly. Too mean-spirited. But you know what? There's also something to be said for stuff that's too mean-spirited. So I don't fully condemn it either, because You kind of get a new perspective. The people on the other end get a new perspective. I think that there is a, by taking that away in its entirety, you get kind of what we were talking about before, this worrisome, bland product that's just like, it's not exploring anything new because it's too safe. Like,
yeah,
you know, the Jessica Alba one, that was maybe too personal. So what I learned at the time was maybe as a young, reckless male, just kind of like give a little more thought to your insults. Although to be fair, I'm sure they don't care. So I think,
you're going to get hashtag me too'd by Jessica Alba. Calling
That's where I don't want to explore those avenues ever. Kind of done with that.
So when you were going to like conventions and stuff, I mean, you must've felt like a celebrity.
It's funny you said that. So there's two reasons why I specifically didn't and simultaneously did, because yeah. I won't shoot that down as a possibility. I really do think there were moments of that. But I remember at the end of, very vividly, at the end of one of the my panels, was the guy came up to me and went like, "Hi, you're just like a normal guy, huh?" Like, you know, and it was at the time where like everyone was pretty much like at the I don't want to say the zenith of the con culture, but it was growing. And like, you know, so comparatively people would come up to me like, "Hey, you're just kind of normal." 'Cause what I did at first, I definitely knew this, it was in order to actually do the panels, I would shut down this part of me that celebrated myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, in order to be like, I wouldn't trust their reaction at all. And that made for like the worst. it wasn't bad, but it wasn't what they were expecting. You know, like I would bring everyone down to like this, like, you know, let's just talk on this level.
So it didn't quite. Okay. So my interpretation, what you're saying is like, you felt like your presentation didn't really fit the mold of people that were in the scene.
Yeah. It sort of killed the vibe that could have been like, you know, everyone just celebrating, like, yeah, woo, this is what it is. You know, and you could definitely play that angle. And it's a powerful one. I think it's fun. And I think people get like a lot of energy. I've definitely done it a couple of times. That's not because I wanted to explore that specifically. I remember the last panel I ever did, probably the most fun, probably like, you know, it was very quaint, very small, but we would like physically get up and just like do things. I was giving out t-shirts. So we'd like, you know, physically just do push-ups, see how many, and I would like try and participate in it. And there was like a different energy to it than just describing, hey, you know, this is what we've been doing. This is how I've been thinking about it, you know, huge. And the audience interacts differently with you too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, on one end, they're like, you know, they think of you as maybe like this thing, and the other end, they're like that thing, to the point where when I would do that, the talking version of, you know, just like calmly, like kind of explaining, like, this is what it is, don't think about it too much, versus the, you know, let's do all like the energy, like high intensity, like just fun stuff. There's nothing else really to it. In that instance, I remember someone specifically standing behind me, you know, because I remembered I ended just like maybe 10 minutes early so I could just like talk to people on an individual basis with that energy still going. And one of the kids, like, I knew what he was thinking because I definitely thought that at one point about people in the conventions.
Yeah.
So he was standing behind me, like thinking like, you know, okay, if I become friends with this person, there's more opportunity for me, you know, somewhere in the back of his mind, there's more potential for me, you know, if I become friends, he's projecting a whole bunch of stuff onto me that I probably couldn't even give him if he wanted.
Right. Yeah.
You know, cause, and when you're younger, I think this is really bringing it around. Your worldview is so, you know, it's all potential, but you only have like a low res understanding of it. So you can project that on it. And it's not unreasonable to think that kid was standing there thinking like, hey, you know, this guy is like, he knows he's got things that I don't know, and he could teach me those things. And there's definitely stuff I could have taught him had I had maybe approached things differently or given him more time. But again, there's like a line of people in front of you. So what are you supposed to do about that? That's the only time, though, that I think I've ever really felt like, you know, that was more towards celebrity than it was towards the understanding part of it.
Well, so, you know, it's kind of weird about audiences. They're very giving. Like, if you have an audience that already has a positive impression of you, they want you to be larger than life. They want you to be the person that they think of, which is, you know, this insane, you know, superstar, even if even if it is just silly internet videos with a couple hundred thousand views. I can definitely see other people fall into maybe a trap. Maybe it's a trap of really believing the impressions that other people give them to the point where it starts to make them unlikable. And that must have been a lot of foresight on your part of trying to avoid that.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely had some insight to that. And I definitely also recognized there's an interesting playback loop that can occur when you think about those people who, as they are larger than life.
Yeah.
So then you're more inclined to not figure out how they got there and instead like focus on the projection that you have of them. So the irony of it is if you just step back and kind of look at them as like, okay, this is a person, what did they do? You can learn those skills and take those skills and kind of almost like adapt and follow in their footsteps in a sense. And like,
yeah, become it's
like,
ironic. It's very ironic.
Yeah. It's just something interesting that I'm trying to like piece together into my mind, but that's just a theory at this point. You know, I usually use my brother as, cause he's on like a different wavelength than me and like a different, like, I think more, I want to say grounded is a good word. He's definitely got a different perspective on things, but he would be more drawn to like, let's say someone like Kanye for Kanye's image. And I would be more drawn to Kanye West is like this is an interesting case study. Like, how did this guy get here?
Okay, so I got one last question about abridging, and then we'll move on to adult life.
Okay.
You mentioned in another interview that you make most of your jokes while editing. Can you talk a little bit about that process and what are sort of the phases and steps that goes into making the sort of high energy videos that you create?
So interestingly enough, like I also try to explore low energy stuff more recently. The latter stuff is specifically spaced out. There is more like space in between them, and you can see the reaction to different people expecting, especially on None Piece. You can see people like expecting the first kind of high energy, high octane stuff, and then the contrast is that slow, methodical pacing in editing. And I think at least in terms of that series, I am specifically constantly trying to change how I approach the quote unquote problem of having the end product, having the video. So I probably have the worst consistent answer for you because I've changed it every time.
That's really interesting though, because, you definitely seem like the kind of person that's not comfortable staying in one place. So that's a really, I mean, you must have all kinds of insights that other people don't get whenever they get stuck into a routine.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of just the one thing I found out is that like, it's difficult to change something, drastically overhaul something, which is what I've done recently because maybe the stuff was so far in between toward the end there that like I will overhaul major things, but tweaking minor things is probably more conducive to a better overall product, like seeing if it fails, seeing if it doesn't, and then like falling back and you know changing something else. Whereas like if you want to explore something completely different and you know that changing one thing would be like useful, but you have to change a whole bunch of other things to do it, I'll jump into that head first. Like just the pacing, the tempo and the pacing. Well, that changes more than just the pacing. That changes how I talk, how people are perceiving it. There needs to be more of a storyline to keep people engaged, at least on some level, you know, but you also lose, you know, the momentum of jokes that could potentially fit more into a certain amount and make people go like, what? Oh, I was focusing on that thought. We're on this thought now. This thought is covering that thought.
It's a totally different experience from the viewer's perspective.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's paradoxical because I think the way you're doing it is the way that, okay, please forgive me for using this word, but the way an artist does it, you know, they really want to explore and find new ways of doing their craft.
Yeah.
So I think that it's kind of one of those unfortunate things about online media because it moves so fast and everyone has so many things to pick from. The things that are consistent and the same over and over are what rise to the top faster.
Yes.
People who really try different things and reach out and branch out and do things that's unlike anything they've ever done before, and really, you know, develop as a creator.
Yeah.
Those people are buried.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And the problem is the algorithm plays against you a little bit, but there is a risk reward, I think. I mean,
yeah.
I don't particularly know, but if you hit the nail on the head that resonates with enough people, because you've taken so much risk in like, you know, not being consistent, you find a completely new avenue of media. You find something new enough that resonates with enough people that becomes the catalyst for something completely new again. But those are far in between. So like,
yeah,
I picture it like sitting at a casino table and being like, okay, they're going to play the constant, mid to high stakes game. You know, the person taking those crazy risks is going to take like the super high risk, like lose it all. And the thing that like I think helps that is like just minimizing your losses at those tables, you know, like that's why I personally don't invest a lot of time into it, because well I'm developing other avenues, so like it's not I don't know, it's not like I have to consistently win at that table. And then there's the low risk stuff, which is
wow, I really really love that metaphor that you're using there. I think it's perfectly encapsulates the gamble. Yeah. It is a gamble. I mean, you try something new and maybe you hit with a different crowd, and maybe that crowd's bigger, maybe the returns are bigger. I mean, yeah. But it's not always about the crowd. I mean, for me, whenever I'm doing something, it's about me. It's what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end of the day, I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I really hope that I can get to a place where like maybe I can release something every once in a while, and it's just fun, and it's just like nice for everyone. After this is all done, I can tell you what I'm working on. I think everyone will really like it. But I don't see myself particularly in, at least not in the short term, short to midterm, doing too much video stuff. Definitely probably not doing abridging stuff, although that seems to be where I'm like most comfortable returning to, but it's also the thing that's like it's the most taxing on me, so I don't know. It's the future is don't look for anything new anytime soon.
Okay. What about Nunn Piece and Codement? What are your plans for those series? Oh,
I think I can't approach them. Okay. I think I literally can't, because there's nothing that can make anyone satisfied.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you've got to try to, one, be consistent with the previous ones. Two, not just imitate yourself, but be genuine. And there's all sorts of traps and little things, and it's a really, really challenging thing. Once there's so much time between a series, at a certain point, you evolve to a point where you can't even do what you used to do.
Yeah, and the landscape changes too, like underneath you. So you're like, okay, I had these views as I was a kid, and I was like kind of going like toward like this kind of thing. Now I have these views, you know. Just I'm not even talking about like crazy, like, you know, insightful views. I'm just talking about like, hey, maybe you shouldn't like make fun of people so much. Although if they're good zingers, you gotta use good zingers.
If they're a fan of comedy, they'll understand.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But my point is that, like, you know, because that's changed so much, how do I approach now what was already like existing and satisfy myself creatively, the audience, like to a certain extent, and make the show's dialogue consistent? Dialogue is in, like, you know, just whatever encompasses it, whatever people think about it.
There's a lot of people out there, when it comes to pleasing yourself and pleasing the audience, they'll lean way too far in one direction and completely alienate the other. And if you do it to where you're alienating yourself, that is, I mean, in terms of being a creator, that's a fate worse than death.
Worse than
just
death.
To become like a monster of the week writer or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the, it's interesting. I like off the cuff stuff. Stuff just comes to me sporadically. New stuff that's particularly like that I like. So I don't know where it comes from a lot of the time. And the problem is I've been focusing so much on where stuff comes from that maybe I need to get in this space where it's like, hey, maybe don't give a shit.
Right. You
know? Yeah.
If there's like, how much am I supposed to analyze this as it's going on? Because you can't not analyze it, but you also can't do it too much. There's a really tricky balancing act there.
Yeah, you're right. Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That's I more or less expected that, but I had to ask. Had to see where you're standing. I mean, I would love to see more stuff from you, man. Every time I watch one of your videos, I'm laughing. So I'll take anything. I'm in the camp you like.
Cool. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Cool.
All right. So we'll go ahead and move on then. So you're engaged now. You've got a significant other. How did you meet this lovely young lady, and how did she react to your YouTube work?
So we met. This is super ironic. I lived with my mother for a while. I didn't see a lot of my dad, but my dad is next door neighbors with her parents.
Okay.
So you'd think that we grew up together, but we didn't. We really didn't. I wasn't around in the house a lot, so she knew my dad. She knew of me, and I knew of her. But it wasn't until we were working. It was, let me see. So after that programming job, I got a job as IT at a hospital. And we both kind of initiated. There's not like a clear cut, like, hey, you know, it was Nick or it was me. And we kind of fell into it. And that was really great. So it was just kind of like, I don't want to say it was just fate, but it was like, it was all the parameters lined up pretty well to where it was like really cool that like, not only were we kind of next door neighbors, but we were basically like on the same floor, walking past each other, like, you know, just, it was really easy to develop a relationship.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she found out about the channel right around the time we like started dating. I was like, listen, like, you know, we had been on like maybe 2 or 3 dates. I was like, I really like you and I really want to hang out, but I'm going to England soon, just to let you know. And she's like, going to England? I'm like, yeah, there's this conference thing. I never called them conventions ever. And I never told anyone in my immediate surroundings I did this stuff. Although the problem was my brother would tell someone, and then it would get, the problem would become like, strange, should be worse than strange.
Yeah, like, why didn't you mention this?
Yeah, I know. Or they wouldn't directly confront me about it. Like they people's attitudes, I'm pretty good at like noticing when like I have a pretty good feeling, like, you know, I've done something on the internet, and I know you're friends with my brother, which is why I suspect that. But like, their attitudes towards me would change a little bit, just a little bit, to the point where I'm now at my job here, and it's, I don't want to get too far into it, but I have a sneaking suspicion, and it's pretty well founded, that somebody knows I do these stuff now because he's a friend of a friend, and that friend knows my brother and talked to him. And whenever that guy talks to me, there's this different energy. It's very like focused and upbeat, but we're never going to directly, you know, talk about it.
Wow.
Yeah. But there's enough in his speech and this other kid's speech to make me think that they know it, specifically about like what they're telling.
It's so weird. It's like you're in the closet.
I know. It's, yeah, exactly. I'm a closet abridger.
A closet abridger. Dude, you know what? I am too, actually. I never tell anybody. I told people that I work on Did You Know Gaming, and so I've gotten.
And they probably, yeah.
There's, that one's big, and I've actually had experiences where I was telling somebody, like, because for a while, that's what I just edited for Did You Know Gaming as. That was my job.
Cool.
And I was telling people, you know, hey, I work on a YouTube channel. They're like, oh, what was it? Digital gaming? He's like, no, you don't. what do you mean?
Really?
He's like, no, you're lying. Like, I got seriously, like, accused in my face of lying. I was like, well, whatever, dude. Whatever you want to believe. It's very strange. But I rarely have ever told anybody about the cartoon stuff. When I told my wife, my now wife, I had to sit her down, and I sat her down, and I had like, I was like, okay, so I need to tell you about something about myself. And she probably thought I was going to say I had like gonorrhea or something like that. I was like, I make cartoon videos on the internet. And she's like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, I know. It's so West. It's like, it's horrible in our minds because we're like worried about their reaction. Like, yeah. That's it? Like,
really? Yeah, I sat her down and I showed her something. Yeah. She was laughing. I felt really good about it. Then, you know, okay, at the time, the most popular thing I had made was rape man.
Yeah, so that was a whole separate conversation. I had to tell her about the other stuff first. I'm like, no, there's more.
Yeah. Yeah, I like all types. It's kind of weird. Like, I try to ignore everything else and just, like, think about what I like. And there's a lot of there's a very small group of people that are, like, kind of our mindset. I don't know what binds us. I'd have to, like, really think about it. There's this other guy. I'm like, maybe I should mention. I really like his stuff. It's Soul Number Brother 3 or whatever.
Soul Bro Number 3? Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, he would be the niche where I would guess, like, in terms of a comedic standpoint, like, he's the next big thing and, like, he's going to take off or, like, whatever. And I don't know if he is or isn't. I haven't seen his stuff in, like, forever. But, like, that comedy just speaks to me personally. So I'm starting to realize that maybe I'm not a good representation of, by and large,
yeah,
the community at all.
Go back just a little bit. What was her reaction to your cartoon videos?
Her reaction to my stuff was, I think it put me in this, like, you know, kind of self-aware state, which I don't get into now, thank God. But I was like, she loved it. She loved it. I explained to her what I did. She was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. I forget who told her. I think it was me. She might have saw, like, because I'm totally cool. We bought her an iPad, and I probably used it once or twice for something. And then she was like, is this you? Like, or like my dad had probably, no, it was definitely my father. My father mentioned, like, and he went to England to, you know, like, talk about his videos. He's like, what videos? I was like, well, I have to tell her. Cause I think I was in the middle of editing something too. So, like, I was like, I make this, and she liked it. She was same exact response. It was just like, oh, thank God. Yeah. And I had, like, a sigh of relief being like, just be like, oh, okay, she knows. She doesn't really, you know, she likes it. And the problem is, I don't show her the end product too. And I get in this way that I don't like when I'm making something. I'll just, like, be much more short, much more like, you know, no, I'm doing this. No, okay, yep. You know, whereas, like, anytime else, like, I have the longest fuse in the world. Not the longest fuse, but that's not true at all. But
No, I get what you mean, though. You're patient. You have patience.
Yeah. I'm more patient. And then, like, with that stuff, the fuse just is immediately shorter. I'm like, why is that? I don't understand. It's maybe because I'm so hyper focused in that arena, and, like, this has got to be perfect. It's got to be all right. I got to put my 100% attention to it, to where, like, yeah, it just shortens my fuse. So that's another reason why I kind of, like, was just explaining, this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. And I don't show her the process of it or anything. Or I do. I do now. I show her, like, all this stuff. But overall, her reaction was way more than understanding and great. It was awesome.
And that's really interesting about the short fuse. I'm the exact same way. I usually have a pretty cool, even-headed temper. But whenever I get interrupted, or whenever it's like, hey, we got to do this thing. It's like, what? Why didn't you tell me?
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. I don't know.
But it's great. I mean, Crystal, I love her so much. She was fine with it. She loved it. She thought it was funny. And she's even been in a few of them now, too. She never was involved in cartoons growing up or voice acting or anything. But she really jumped in and joined me with it. So. Cool. She's just the coolest.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well, congrats.
Yeah. I really lucked out there. I mean, that's why we're married, but.
Yeah.
Well, not because she was. Okay. Back up. We're not married because she was in my videos. We're married because she is the kind of person who would do that, even though she had no connection.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's always, I think that's, like, and it strengthens, like, the kind of, like, the communication at the very least.
Yeah.
In the relationship. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I'm glad.
And she's super patient when I'm directing her voice acting because she'd never done it before. I'm like, nope, you got to do it again. She's like, what?
Yeah. I've learned that's a whole other beast in and of itself. And I've learned to be more patient in that arena too.
Mm-hmm.
Cause, like, you know, at first I think, like, it's just jittery and you don't see it from their perspective. And that's really hard to do too.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, they want a line specifically in their head that, like, you know, interacts with all these other lines, and they're not thinking about a lot of the good directors. I've been doing this stuff a long time to now where it's like, I know the directors that are kind of, it's going to take longer and the thing in their head is so it's not obtainable from my perspective because I can't bring them what exactly what they want. So it's frustrating for both of us. And it's a dialogue we have throughout, like, you know, performing the line.
Yeah.
But it because I recognize that that is a dialogue and it's not just a, like, you know, this is me on the podium and I have to get this right 100%. I've gotten more patience with it, I think.
Right. Yeah. That's a good actor, being patient with the director. And directors are always, like, renowned for being assholes. And it's because they've got so much they're juggling in their head, they don't have a lot of extra space to deal with your feelings.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So if you're bringing that to the table and they're like, oh, there's, like, that role of, like, the, oh, God damn it. Now I had,
yeah, now I got to deal with this too. Yeah. Fuck it. I'll get somebody else. Yeah. Get out of here.
Yep.
You're gone.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's all that I have on Abridging. We'll go ahead and move on completely to life. So I understand that you've been contributing to society in important ways for a while. You've been a lifeguard. You've gone to college. Yeah. You've worked at a hospital, yep, a nuclear plant. Yeah. So you said you have a degree in computer science. What was your college experience like?
Not so great.
Really?
From like an overall standpoint, I wish I had done more research.
Research, like, you wish you had researched more while you were in college, or researched before you got into college?
Before I got into college, because I knew I liked computers. I knew I liked, you know, playing games. I knew I liked just generally what was showing up on there. I'm sure I had it in my head one point that I could be like a programmer, and programming was easy and fun.
No, it's not.
Yeah, oh no. So I went to school, and as a declared computer science major, you know, I wanted to get started on that early. And I went to Vermont because I had this other idea in my head that I would go away and just become this other thing. When I came back to my family, they would be like so amazed and like just be like, wow, I don't know why this was. You're like, wow, you've really changed, and look at you. You know, you're physically bigger, you're stronger, and you're smarter and all this stuff. And I think, like, I cast it out. I had a pretty damn good support system throughout, you know, because I formed like tightly knit relationships in grade school and high school. My college experience was like drastically culturally different from what I was experiencing in high school. Literally, things would change. Things like, I'm just gonna say marijuana. like people's reaction to that, and, like, you know, how it was being dealt with and who was dealing with it. I was right outside of the city. So like I said, we had like a really interesting mix of people. It was, I can't believe, like, it was fascinating to me because it gives me such a better insight now than I have been when I talk to people in other cultures, talking from the outside of a perspective of a culture. So, like,
yeah,
Vermont, upstate Vermont, take that of what you will. It's primarily, like, you know, just upstate Vermontians. You anyone can figure out, like, what that kind of means, I'm sure, at this day and age.
Homogeneous culture.
Yeah, homogeneous, very, very similar. And what was even more interesting was that these were all private school kids. So they had been with each other since grade school. So all their understandings of the world were very uniformal. And the way they talked about certain topics was like, the topic you're talking about, I understand completely, but I think you're an outsider because you don't know individuals in that topic. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm being extremely, like, you know, general, but
no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. So it was mainly, it became, I remember this is the first time I really had like a real bully, and I want to talk about my bullies throughout my life, quote unquote bullies. But there was this guy, he's the only guy I've ever been rooming where he was doing coke. I've only like ever seen that once. You can leave that in there because I won't give him the name. But he just singled me out because I definitely wasn't fitting the dynamic of all the private school kids. I clearly wasn't up on my drug lingo. I clearly wasn't up on, like, you know, all the stuff that was specifically cool in college. I was learning, but not at a fast enough pace. And what was interesting was his roommate took a liking to me because he recognized, you know, that was, he had a friend that was just like that. So he was like trying to teach me all this stuff. I learned a lot from him. Unfortunately, he didn't do well in school, and then he got kicked out, so he wasn't there the next semester, and that was just like a hell to me. So, like, I kind of just distanced myself physically from that whole scenario, that whole, what the fuck was it? What the fuck I'm looking for? Situation. And that's when I like really couldn't, like, I was probably a little too isolated, more than I should have been. Like, it was a lot harder for me to, like, you know, trust a lot of the kids on the campus then.
It sort of set the wrong tone then, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And they, and I had had a sequence of bad interactions after that, and I did, and looking back on them now, I laugh at them so hard, because like this is one time I was talking to another group of kids and they just were not responding to me at all, and I was like, Jesus, like I'm already like in a rut and they must hate me. They were clearly on ecstasy. I was completely misinterpreting that whole situation, because I had found out from someone else that they had been later on, and it was only much, much later on. I was like, oh, like those were the kids doing that. They were like staring through me and just be like, but the problem is that they had like, they came to eat lunch and all of them were eating lunch silently staring at things.
You know, you probably read that totally wrong. If they were on ecstasy, when you were speaking, they're like, oh my God, this is God. God is speaking.
I know. It was these intense stares and then nothing.
I love this person's soul.
Yeah, I know. And then they would like look away to something else, but they would, because they were on the same wavelength, they could make communication. They would communicate towards them like just kind of fine. And it was strange. I didn't understand it. They would be like, I don't know if, like, I'm going to be ridiculous. This is not what they would say. But like, I don't know about rainbows, you know? Rainbows are weird. And I was like, huh, I was just asking about how we can get, you know, our cars on campus, because I'm not sure about that process. But yeah, rainbows are cool too.
So there was basically a culture shock. You moved from sort of the middle class, sort of multicultural area into a more affluent upper class, I'm guessing, yes. White crowd.
Yes.
And they were doing the things that those people do, which are drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it was like really interesting to me to see that dynamic play out. But yeah.
So you changed colleges then. Was that a result of not having a really good go at it in Vermont?
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it was. And it's funny, like, even I call them bullies, but I never, like, on some level, I still, like, you know, talk to that guy, and like he was still like more friendly, even if it was just like a general kind of hostility towards me that like I could dissipate if I was one-on-one, because I was super agreeable.
Right.
But yeah, because I wasn't like forming those really deep connections that I was used to, accustomed to. Now then I've then learned to, like, you know, learn how to, like, you know, just have, like, you know, surface friends and be like really good. Because they're the gateway to, like, you know, the better relationships. I've separated the two, which is really nice. But I at the time wasn't having a great experience. Then I moved to Manhattan, where I struggled for just a little bit, because again I had another shock. I was in a room. It was dormed with. So it was such an interesting group of kids. My roommate was deaf. Like, literally DEAF. They didn't throw a dead guy in there. But and then
I was rooming with Death, you know, the fictional character, the one with the sight.
You know, you could take that metaphorically too, and it's like, it was just Death. Like, you know. Yeah, but
guy could party.
Yeah. So like it was difficult to communicate again for different reasons.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I had a great experience with that guy, and then in the room next to us, they were set up kind of weird. There was just two kind of more, again, like distant guys who weren't there a lot. So I had gotten my own room again, not on his part, but I think he was having like a difficult time with, like, you know, generating sound. And I was like, you know what, if I moved out, I figured out that it would be good for him and good for me. Then my cousin came into the picture, because he was having sort of a rough go of it out of another school. So it just turned out that, like, you know, I'd had a single. We wanted to make it like two. And that's when, again, I learned to get my footing. It was a great solid base. And then that's when the bridging started. And that's when I had like a really great time again.
Cool.
Yeah.
So outside of college, now these days, you have a very unique and fascinating job working in a nuclear plant. Can you... Can you tell us what you do there and what that's like?
Yeah, absolutely. So now it's weird, because I guess technically I'm management at a nuclear facility. That's the easiest description of it. I'm managing the general performance of the plant, and specifically in terms of the department is called production, which is, you know, how well we're scheduling our stuff, how well the maintenance is going. And I try to improve our department. But I'm basically, the reason they hired me is because I have database, you know, knowledge, and I definitely work with all their databases, but I would not say that's the majority of my job. You know, there's at a power plant, people kind of think of it as just like a quick snapshot. It's just the power plant is generating great. It's like, it's always decaying. It's, this is the way I picture it. It's like taking 100 cars, filling them in a stadium, and then using those cars to power a battery. So those cars are going to break down. You got to do maintenance on them constantly. And that's what goes on in any kind of power generating facility. And I feel like the dialogue doesn't, a lot of the mainstream dialogue doesn't take a lot of that into consideration. So when they talk about the costs of individual power production, there's a lot more to be said. And I am not biased toward my own industry.
Yeah.
I'm sure I am on some level. You know, there's always that bias.
You got to live. You got to eat.
Exactly. But I'm in this. Interesting position where it's guaranteed. Well, not 100%, but it's. I'd say it's 100%. It's 100% guaranteed. We are going to shut down in 3 years.
Really? So how do you? How do you shut down a plant that has radioactive waste?
That's a great question. So,
is that your job to figure out?
No, and thank God. Although I could try and transition into that job, which would be insane. But there are these giant casks with the radioactive material, and they're covered in, like, I'm gonna botch the number, but I'm gonna say it's like maybe a foot and a half thick of concrete. And then inside that concrete, there's basically like a layer of water and pool, because the radiation does not travel well through water. And then there's another concrete that's like X amount of feet thick, you know? So there's just a bunch of those casks that are sitting there that have, since the beginning of the life of the plant, they're just no longer usable as fuel. So they're sitting there. And
how long does that take? 1,000 years?
Yeah. It's like ridiculously long. It's ridiculously long. The half-life, I don't even know the half-life. I couldn't, because it's I think it's, we use uranium-238, or maybe that's the byproduct and we use 235. I don't know. I'd have to look at it. but I should know this off the top of my head. It's not
that, me. Now I'm picturing you as Homer, just sitting at your desk with a box of donuts, like, I don't know, push this button?
Yeah, exactly. it's not one person knows everything about the plant, but the right guys to ask about that kind of stuff would be the guys we call ops guys, the operation guys. That's their main concern. And I'm picking up enough. My first day was literally like in the pool where they have the, that was really weird. It was such an eye-opening experience. Like, and literally the job that helped me the most in that moment, when I first got the job anyway, it's really weird, because when you refuel, and it's a privately owned company, you want to get back online as quickly as possible. So they make you work 12-hour shifts 6 days a week. By the way, I should have said this at the beginning of this whole thing. I just came out of a refueling period. Like, just came out of it yesterday. So we were working 12-hour days, 6 days a week. And that one day, you're just basically, it's only for like a month or however long it takes to get the fuel in and get started and do all the maintenance that you can do offline, that you have to do to get back online. That's why I'm like super, I have so much energy right now, because I had a day off yesterday.
Freedom!
And it was, yeah, a long time. But anyway, I was in that refueling moment. It was during that time frame. And all I had to do was watch a crane. Literally, I watched a giant 50-foot, it's way more than 50-foot. It's like, it's just, I don't even know how big it is. It's a giant crane that I have to make sure is not bumping into anything, and I have to blow a horn. So my lifeguarding experience helped out the most.
Wow, that's crazy. Full circle.
I know, yeah. Just looking out for danger and then blowing a whistle, or in this case, a horn.
Not falling asleep.
Yeah. So not too glamorous in that moment. But then when I got to my online job, that's what we call it. It's just like when you're actually operating, That's when I, like, you know, got all the nuances and learned all, like, that. I'm still learning stuff every day.
So you have a perspective on nuclear energy that you could really understand all the moving pieces, and you could make a judgment call that a lot of people aren't actually knowledgeable enough to make.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not the best. I'm definitely not the best. I'm nowhere near the best.
Right, but as a productivity manager, you have an intimate familiarity with every step of the process and every single moving piece of the whole machine. Would you say that?
Yeah, I'd say so. There's points where, like, I don't know, like, I'll just know the general overall view. Like, you know, I'll get they call it the work order, because they're always doing work, and they'll say, like, go fix, like, this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll kind of know certain things about it, but then you'd need, like, an electrician who would actually be, like, you know, the guy who would be like, oh yeah, we opened up that box and there's this, that, and the other thing. And then the engineers know about their specific groups, because it's a lot and it's not a lot at the same time. The way I describe it is, it's just like you're just trying to move steam. That's all you're trying to do.
It's really, I mean, a fire could do this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you have enough fire, there you go. You can generate power. You know, there's a bit about, like, a static field that you got to worry about. But other than that, like, you know, just move the water to make the turbine spin so you get a static field so you can push electrons through a thing.
That's amazing. But energy is, you know, it's such an important part of our lives, and yet I think that many people just don't even think about it at all. They just pay their bill and watch TV. But nuclear energy is interesting because it doesn't have any, like, I'm going to say, like, to the larger society, it doesn't have any short-term adverse side effects like smog or disrupting wildlife or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it's also controversial for, you know, what we were talking about before, the time dedication. You really have to put your chips all in that this whole society thing is going to work out in the long term. But, you know, you have sort of the initial wave of nuclear plants around the world, and then you have the backlash against it. And today, I think people are still kind of split on whether or not they like it or don't like it. So what's your take on the history of nuclear energy and your familiarity with it?
So I've trying to learn more and more. I know that as a response to that dialogue, they've made it a lot safer. I will definitely say that, just from objectively, from like a Chernobyl perspective to now.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely something that's improved to where, like, we're not hearing about it all the time, these plants melting all over the country. And yes, there are nuclear plants all over the country.
Yeah, there's one about 45 minutes to the south of where I live.
Oh, really? Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, so.
Sometimes
so
it's just
everywhere.
Yeah, it's out of sight, out of mind, though. You're right. And I remember the perspective of just, like, not even thinking about how our lights are on right now and, like, you know, how all that stuff's on, and then being like, oh, this is how it works. Nuclear definitely has, like, a lot of costs, but I think everyone just thinks of, like, a giant bomb. The problem was also, like, the terminology too, and they've done, like, a lot of stuff to make it safer. I mean, I could go into, like, days, like, you have regulation to the point where, and maybe that's the reason why we're closing in the north, and there's different regulations all over the country, because there's different nuances all over the country. There was, and I can say this safely because I know that this was a bit on The Simpsons. The Simpsons featured Indian Point. This is super ironic too. It's like crazy. The bit in The Simpsons was Indian Point is playing against the Springfield team. And, you know, they have Mr. Burns talking with a fictional owner of our of our facility. And they're like, and they talk about how, oh, I think we're going to close and go into, you know, this industry. Or I think we're going to close and sell this and, you know, go into the stock market or something like that. And that's the joke. And the reality of it is that, yes, right around the time it was announced we were going to close. So I remember seeing that and being like, my initial reaction was, that's bullshit. We don't have a baseball team. And then ironically, yeah, we got a baseball team and now I'm on it. I swear to God, I was talking to one of the guys in this last refueling outage and he's like, he really liked me. Like, you know, I'm getting along a lot better with a lot of the guys there. And like, hey, you want to be on the baseball team? I'm like, yeah, you know what? I do.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's the Simpsons predicting the future in two new ways. You know how people always say the Simpsons predict the future with like the president being Trump and all that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they got it right again.
On such a personal note.
I know. It's ridiculous. I'm like, oh my God, yeah, now I'm on the team.
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go.
So, all right, I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. When we were emailing back and forth, you mentioned that you're avoiding Twitter, and we talked about it a little bit. I've actually been struggling with social media, too. I quit for a while, and then I joined again, and now I just don't use it anymore. I feel like every time I load it up, I either get like pissed off or encounter some kind of other negative feeling. What do you think it is about social media that's so fun and interesting at first, but then you have, you know, people like you and me who, you know, you just kind of give up on it over time?
Yeah. My first realization was with Reddit, because Reddit was the moment in which, like, you know, there was always this one-sided dialogue, and I definitely left that first. And I realized that, like, and this is how I knew I probably wouldn't come back to it. This is my ultimate test. Like I was saying before, during that refueling outage, you are working 12-hour shifts 6 days a week, but because of what they're having us do, like I'll pick up a significant amount of dose, and I can say, that's not true. I'm not picking up a significant amount of dose, but I have to be aware that I am in these jumps where it's really hot. It's hot because, you know, we're trying to cool a core, and that crane that I was talking about before, it's in a containment area, you know, as part of a safety protocol. So it's like, really, even though you could be doing the most simple thing, like just walking around a really slow moving crane, but it's like a lot of work, because like you're dressed in full paper scrubs because you're worried about the radiation potentially, you know, and there's all these safety precautions that you have to take, to where it's like it's just draining on you in general. So they give you, usually it's like 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And it really turns out to be, the reason they do that is because you need that time in that 2 hours down, A, to recover and like get ready to go back into a super hot place where it sucks. And like, you know, there's state regulations that we can't be working in those places for more than a certain amount of time. So, and we have to get dressed up and dressed out. So that's part of the break. So it's really like 2.5 hours on, 1.5 hours off. The reason I mention that is because during that 1.5 hours off, like, I actually get time to do stuff, and you get generally bored. They know our specific team gets so bored. I have seen site VPs know this. We just watch videos, or like, you know, because we're just, there's downtime. We're generally recovering. And that's what's really, really cool about what they do. And I like that. So I got so bored consuming like so much media, to the point where I was like, I told myself specifically, if you can go a month and a half without watching this, then it's not really providing you any long-term utility. It's not really like, you can avoid it and make and see how your life is without it. I just noticed it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It was just better. And I started working out as a substitute, which is amazing. I feel great right now. There's always this moment during the outage. I plan my outages. Like, we have a gym that's part of the plant. It's outside the plant. It's like right outside the plant. It's almost always barren and empty, and always on my breaks, instead of watching movies and looking at Reddit, I just go work out, and I feel freaking phenomenal. Like, even right now, I started eating better. I started paying attention to like stuff that I would just like be like, whatever, food's food. Like, no, I'm not taking enough like vitamins. I'm like really turning stuff around. And when you have that to contrast with social media, I think the most recent thing I did was, now that I'm understand, like, you know, okay, it's not providing me with such a great utility, what is it in its entirety, and how are people reacting to it? And Twitter specifically is not rewarding enough, to the point where like the platform doesn't help you, even if you were creating something else and trying to show people that other thing. You know what I mean? Like, in specific, like YouTube, or like maybe you're a painter and you're trying to show like your new art. Art tends to do well on there. But there'd be these flash in the pan. I'm sure they're working on their algorithm all the time. By the time you're probably done with editing this, it's been different, and maybe it's improved. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. But like, I would go and where I'd see like there's controversial statements and people would be sharing stuff on Facebook. Facebook's the one thing I'll kind of scroll through because at least I have my friends using the filters for the content I'm seeing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember once somebody posted something about like a controversial Facebook quote that was from Twitter. So I went to that person's Twitter account and it's totally not representative of that person. And it is representative of that person and their work, but not of like the impact that it has on probably that person's life overall, because it was like a flash in the pan. There's like 50,000 retweets and like, you know, 80,000 likes. And then the rest of it is like two people. Three people have like looked at this. So I was like, and I'm sure that that person wanted, because of what was specifically in the tweet, and I won't say it because it's like controversial, wanted those 50,000 people to at least interact with those people all the time. I'm like, well, if that's your end goal and this is the platform you're using, those two things don't mesh. Those things two don't meet. So you're not even, you're not even accomplishing the goal that you as a creator or you as a person who's trying to get a viewpoint across to other people are you know, that was maybe their point. Well, then the account doesn't work for what it was designed for. It's designed for something else.
Right. Yeah. When I come out of this, I'm worse than when I went in. And in addition to that, I'm missing out on all kinds of other stuff in the real world. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. I mean, I feel I want to say this because I know so many other people who've done the same thing. I really want to say that. I really hope that as a culture we're gonna turn or at least be aware of how these things are impacting us and changing our perception of ourselves and other people in a way that will ultimately be better than what it was before. But right now I honestly feel that social media has made us worse, and I'm not really sure. I don't feel comfortable saying that, but I mean,
yeah, I'm with you. And I like that you also mentioned that optimism there, because I've been learning like everything is kind of like a process. You got to like walk through it. It's not just like a set, like solitary guarantee thing all the time.
Right. Cause I mean, this shit was, it didn't exist 5 years ago, or maybe it did, but like, it wasn't what it is now.
Yeah.
And just seeing this election was awful.
Oh, yeah.
It was terrible just in terms of all the broken ties and all of the people who you end up you used to respect so much, and it's like, what happened to you?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny. I have a we could be here forever, but I think I have a smoking pistol as to why and how things got polarized. Or it's not particularly a smoking pistol, but it's the easiest way for me to compartmentalize the dynamic shift in how everyone is understanding the platforms now as they do. And specifically because it's tied to the people that kind of discovered and have said that they've discovered, like they were part of the dialogue, quick dopamine responses.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, it is. It's sort of like a drug almost when you look at it like that.
And certain people, but maybe there is, I think there is like a threshold for that. Like, you know, as your returns become like, you know, slower and worse, you kind of like, I mean, I'm going to assume you and I are kind of like, you know, just at that point, because maybe we're just indicative of what's going to happen with a lot more people, or maybe more people have, and we don't have enough, you know, feedback from the people who are out of the loop, because where would you get that data from?
Right.
You know
what I mean? Where's the social media site for people who have exiled from social media? I need to connect with these people. I need to see what they're thinking. I need to show them things and get likes.
I know exactly. Oh God, it's really full circle now. Yeah.
Well, some people really are addicted to it. I mean, in the class that I teach, these kids are constantly on Snapchat and Instagram. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how they live their life. That's the lens for which they view socializing with other people. If you're not on Snapchat, then you're not shit. And you know, these they've more or less had this stuff as part of their lives since they were young. I mean, we're talking about people who are high school juniors, seniors.
I
wonder, what is the future going to be like? How are these platforms going to evolve? How are they going to continue to shape the conversation and the perception? And I don't have a lot of optimism. The optimism is, like you were saying, how
how can we come out of it better? Like, what is I mean, there's certainly going to be things that are better than they were before. Yeah. There's certainly also going to be things that are worse than they were before. So it's just kind of a matter of, like, you know, what is the ultimate outcome here? And I'm curious. I'm going to keep an eye on it, but I'm not going to participate much anymore.
Yeah, no, me neither. I just, especially not right now. Yeah, you're right. And I picture it the same way, like you were talking about, like, kids and their perspective. I picture it the way kind of like I see television. Like, I'm sure they don't see television the way I see television now. And my perception of television has changed. It's kind of become like the radio. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an arcane, such an outdated concept. What, they're just, they tell you what to watch? I don't think so.
I know. Yeah, no, not anymore.
So I'll bring it right around to back to creation. I just want to close out our conversation with just a little brief discussion from a content creator point of view, so to speak. If you had to talk to your younger self, just starting out your YouTube experience, knowing what you know today, what would you say to him?
I would say, be nicer, first of all. Think about the fact that you're a person. Would you like that said about you? I understand that they might have status that, like, you don't fully comprehend. there's nothing particularly wrong with being consistent, being concise. But I don't know if I want to tell him that, because maybe I would want him to evolve out of it.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
You get done with the conversation, you're a completely different person. You're like, what happened?
I know. Like, what did I just do? Oh, no. There's like 90,000 episodes. Like, oh, like, what was I thinking? yeah, there we go. Just generally, I don't know if I'd say too much more, because I feel like I learned a lot from it. Just be more active in, like, what you're doing, what you're learning. Maybe be a little less active. You'll be more active later, so just appreciate this time now while you have it.
That's great. No, that's perfect, because that's not, you know, that's not just about abridging. That's about everything. You don't take your time for granted as a kid. Use it to develop skills, and which you did. I mean, you definitely did.
Yeah, yeah. That's definitely what I would say. If we could just boil it down to one, that's what I would say.
Again, I appreciate your time, and have a good one.
You too.
That's the show, everybody. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Nick, for taking the time to record this interview. I had a really great time chatting with Nick recording this show, and also, don't miss the other stuff that we worked on in that time, too. Nick starred as Gold in the Voodoo Moose abridged Pokemon movie, and there's also a Kind Soundwaves version of this interview, which I mentioned before, and includes samples of the stuff we were talking about, and a few more segments. So, thanks for listening. Subscribe on YouTube, subscribe on iTunes, check out more videos and podcasts from Voodoo Moose. The theme song is Barge by Gunnar Olsen. And to all you listeners, have a great week.